Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
Talking with Paul DiFilippo.
Yeah, that's a good enough pronunciation.
And we're here at the ReaderCon 11 in Waltham, Massachusetts. Paul's agreed to talk to us a little bit about his ideas about the future of science fiction. Tell me a little bit about your early writing history, Paul. You have been writing for a long time in various genres.
Well, I actually sold my first story back in 1977 and didn't really pursue that for a sale for a good 5 years after that. You know, I had various jobs and life kind of interrupted as it has a habit of doing. And in 82, I got really serious about trying to see if I could make a go of my writing, and here it is 17 years later. I had a day job for the past 15 years, various day jobs, and I've just now managed over the past couple of years to kind of reach a point where the writing sustains me at a certain minimal level. So it's been a fun haul, but also a little scary and tedious at times, but it's been a good, I guess 22 years now if you go back to the 1977 sale, but and in that time I've managed to have 4 books of short stories appear, and 1 solo novel and a collaborative mystery novel just came out last year. Called Would It Kill You to Smile is the title, and Michael Bishop and I wrote that together, but we issued it under a pen named Philip Lawson. Mm-hmm. So that's
Straight mystery?
Straight mystery, yeah. We had fun doing it, trying to rein ourselves in, not to introduce any speculative elements, although we had one little minor bout of maybe you could rationalize it as telepathy, but you didn't have to, you know. we had to put a little something in for that.
And you've also been a COBOL programmer.
That was my flirtation with the real world. That kind of intervened between, that was like in the period of 79 to 82. I worked for an insurance company, writing the most boring code imaginable, processing claims and displaying claim information on screens and stuff. But it was interesting to get a little taste of what programmers do and what the insurance world is like, and it made me realize that was part of the impetus in 82 for deciding that if I didn't pursue my writing, I'd be a COBOL programmer forever. So
that would probably scare a lot of people into becoming a good writer.
Absolutely, yeah. Although I probably could have made more money the past year if I had resurrected my COBOL skills and tackled the Y2K problem, but I resisted that temptation, too.
A lot of the Y2K threats at this point seem a little science fictional in retrospect.
Yeah, it was a lot of hype, obviously. You know, they're not... I don't think we're going to see civilization crash down around our ears as much as some of us might like it to happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of hopeful hype, I think, on some people's part.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Now I'll get my Ferrari. I'll just go steal it from the lot when all the computers are down.
You know, I got the Udny Readers Y2K booklet, and they were like, this is finally the opportunity for us all to talk to our neighbors and start composting and all that kind of stuff.
Although I did see some of that. We had, the East Coast was hit by that blizzard in 78, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And it is amazing what a temporary paralysis like that it can do, because, I mean, the city streets were just, you know, covered with snow, totally impassable. People were out making trails and skiing and having outdoor barbecues in the middle of the blizzard and stuff. And it was just, it is a liberating thing, but I don't think we want the chaos and savagery that goes along with the total collapse. I think we can do without that.
Now, one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you was that you've been a proponent recently of an idea called Ribofunk, that you think that science fiction hasn't been pushing the boundaries the biotechnology impacts are going to be for us in the future. Can you tell me a little bit about where those ideas have come from?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I coined the term Ribofunk. I took... let me give a little background first. It was kind of the height of cyberpunk. We're talking a period of maybe, you know, between 1985 and 87. And I was swept up in the cyberpunk movement to some extent because Bruce Sterling chose one of my stories to appear in Mirror Shades, which was kind of the anointed cyberpunk Bible of the time. So I was on the fringes of that movement. I'd written, you know, three or four stories that kind of tallied with the cyberpunk vision. And it was an era of manifestos and creeds and rivalries and internecine wars in the science fiction community. And I started thinking how I could help foment this kind of this kind of bad behavior. And so I said, kind of tongue in cheek, I said, let me coin a term for a new movement. But as I started to think about this thing that started almost as a prank, I started to take it seriously. And I had written a couple of stories at this point that I actually saw were kind of prototypes for what I had in mind in terms of a new direction that science fiction could move in. So also, you have to remember at this time that Greg Bear had gotten a lot of attention for his novel Blood Music, yes. Which started in shorter form, but then
nanovirus eat the entire human race.
Exactly, it started. He was really the first to kind of among the cyberpunks, because he too was dragged into the cyberpunk camp, you know, half willingly, half screaming. He was really the kind of first to. Focus on biological possibilities of technologies that were loose out there. Although Bruce Sterling himself had, with his Shaper Mechanist stories, had started to look a little bit in that direction. Right. But in any case, I had some sort of natural predilection towards biology as opposed to chemistry and physics. I've never taken a science course higher than high school level, unless you count. I think I had an astronomy course in college. I was always an English major and a literature and history buff. So totally, you know, but I'd read Scientific American every month and read all the popular science books that I could lay my hands on. And so biology appealed to me more than, you know, the so-called harder sciences. So I started thinking, well, I've written a couple of stories that kind of tackle speculative biology, and maybe that would be a good kind of movement to coin. And about this time, too, Gregory Benford, another wonderful science fiction writer, had said that just as the 20th century was the century of physics, so will the 21st century be the century of biology. Mm-hmm. So with these kind of inputs and ideas floating around the air... Well,
in the 80s, Jeremy Rifkin said the same thing.
Sure.
In Algenate, he said that.
Sure, okay, I haven't read Algenate, but he was another face on the horizon or figure on the horizon that was kind of tickling, you know, at my fancy as to what... where we were heading. So I took the, I said, well, every new movement needs a buzz name, you know, that it can be instantly evoked by. And of course, cyberpunk was the model. And you had, that word was coined, half science, half pop culture. You had cybernetics, and then you had punk music. So I said, let me see if I can do something similar. So I, took the ribosome, which is, you know, a very important part of cellular machinery, and then I had never been a big fan of punk music. You know, I liked a little bit of it, but I was always kind of into the more melodic punk, like the Jam and folks like that. So funk music was something that appealed to me. So I said, well, there's the pop culture half of my new coinage, and then I just sheared off half of ribosome and came up with the ribopot, and I stuck them together. And it's really spooky what happens when you do something like that, because it's like letting a new meme loose in the world. And now you go to a search engine on the web and you type in ribofunk, and there's like 800 or 1,000 references to it. And that, you know, it's kind of a weird responsibility to coin this new meme and let it loose out in the world, and then all of a sudden it starts replicating. You know, you feel like, who was it, Robert Morris, that guy who let the worm loose on the internet several years ago. So so then I said, well, now I've got this great coinage, I better issue a manifesto. And I typed up like about 500 words or 300 words, very didactic and propaganda. And I just did a Xerox of it, kind of like Bruce Sterling did with Cheap Truth. You know, it was started out as a Xerox fanzine. And I mailed it out to a bunch of friends. And then it got reprinted here and there in a magazine or two. And I called it the Riboflunk Manifesto. And then after all this, I said, well, gee, I better start.
Is that available on the web?
Somebody, I think, has posted. I think you might find it. You might find it on the web. There was a fellow named Patrick Clark, a friend of mine who I've never met, just a pen pal. He's heavily into Philip K. Dick, and he also has been kind enough to say good things about my work. But he has a web page, and I think he might have reprinted it on his web page. Later on, years down the road, I did a second installment, like the Riboflunk Manifesto updated, and that appeared in a couple of places. Nonstop magazine printed it, and also I think a British magazine, but that might be on the web too. But it was just kind of a rough schematic of the kind of fiction that I envisioned would result from this fusion of biology, concerns about biology, and I was not neglecting the musical aspect of it too, because just as punk was sardonic and bitter and had this very cold surface, and you know, best exemplified maybe by Molly's implanted mirror shades in Neuromancer, just as cyberpunk had this kind of cold surface, I pictured that Riboflunk would have a more jazzy and kind of syncopated and lilt to it, and not be afraid. Yeah, exactly, and not be afraid to be kind of upfront about emotions and things, and just, you know, you'd have these kind of James Brown screaming passages in Riboflunk stories instead of these and the James Brown scream wouldn't be the Johnny Rotten scream, you know, it'd be a more gut thing instead of a Edvard Munch cry of anguish or whatever. So in any case, I had this notion. I said, well, gee, I better write some stories to go along with this. I've got a couple that are kind of prototypes, but maybe I can refine it. So over the years, being, you know, interested in selling to various magazines, I stuck with the short story form, and the stories would crop up here and there. And then when I had a number of them, like 10 or 11, I said, well, these now almost make a volume, but I better do a couple of bridging ones. And so I did two new ones, and then they eventually appeared in print under the title Riboflunk.
Riboflunk. And one of the things that you really are trying to show with that is that our speculations in most of science fiction about the future of the human body and the impacts of biotechnology, we're just beginning to see hard science fiction writers begin to explore radically extended lifespans, radically different forms of the human form, the impact of viral contagion getting out of control. And so can you talk a little bit about why we're so afraid, why writers have been so afraid to really go in that direction?
Well, I think some of it stems from H.G. Wells's famous dictum when he was laying down what he saw as rules for speculative writing. He said, you can have a strange environment or a strange character, but you can't have both because that's too much strangeness for the reader to identify with. So generations of science fiction writers concentrated on the strange environment. You know, if you were going to invent, a world where... like Ringworld or Heavy Planet by Hal Clement or something, you could have strange aliens. That was fine because aliens were, you know, always strange by definition. But the human protagonist would basically be your standard run-of-the-mill, you know, 20th century humans in bodily form and often in their attitudes. And that was because the reader, those would be the characters that would be the viewpoint characters that the reader would identify with. And I think it was kind of felt subconsciously that, you know, you couldn't tamper with the basic human form too much, or if you had also the strange environment, because then the reader would be totally at sea. He'd have nothing left to identify with. Now, you could tamper with the human form if you wanted to do like a Superman story, and I'm not referring to the comic book character, but the notion of, you know, something a more than human character, and you could kind of mess with you could have like characters who had telepathic powers or whatever, but they were still basically...
Sturgeons more than human.
Right, Sturgeons more than human, or A.E. Van Vogt with Slan and stuff, but they were still basically, you know, it was that nice bipedal character with the same basic human parameters, biological parameters, and they never were really messed with because I think readers feared creating these kind of freak characters maybe that wouldn't be identifiable with by the writers feared creating these characters that readers couldn't identify with. So I think science fiction labored for a long time under that Wellesian dictum that you know, you couldn't mess with both the characters and the environment at the same time. But that is kind of false because the environment, you know, is going to shape the character and vice versa. The character is going to shape their environment. So I think to have that synergy between environment and character is just more heightened, you know, it heightens the realism rather than I think it takes away from it. There were instances in the past where writers really messed with the container that human intelligence went in. I'm thinking of something like Fred Pohl's book about colonizing Mars, whose title...
Man Plus.
Yes, Man Plus. And there you had, you know, they instead of terraforming Mars, which is all the rage now, they turned the character into a creature capable of living on Mars, and he wasn't, you know, the standard human model after a while when they were done with him.
Later he had uploading where the consciousness in the machines was going at 200 times the clip of human consciousness and radically different lifespans.
So there have been you know, mileposts or milestones along the way in science fiction that I kind of look back to for my inspiration. There was a great Clifford Simak story called Desertion, where it's part of the City sequence, where they take a man and it's funny, it was written like in the 40s, early 50s, and totally implausible now, but they decide they're going to make a man into something that can live on the surface of Jupiter, which is just, you know, it's right. What we know now with our probes and stuff, it would just be impossible, but they turn this guy into what's basically an alien, you know, they totally restructure his body and stuff. And then in the wonderful Simak homey touch, they decide he needs a helper, so they do the same thing to a dog. So they send this modified man and dog down to the surface of Jupiter, and they say, okay, you're our exploration team. Oh, and the hook is that nobody has ever come back. They've done this several times before, and nobody has ever come back. So the man and the dog end up on the surface of Jupiter, and it's wonderful. Their new bodies are so in tune with the environment, and there's all these methane winds blowing around, and they can see strange hills off in the distance. Somehow they have vision that works on the surface of Jupiter. And... they start roaming around the Jovian landscape there, and then they realize that nobody's ever reported back for pickup because life is so wonderful in this new body on the surface of Jupiter that and they have telepathy, of course, because they can't speak. You know, regular voices won't work under the Jovian conditions. So the dog telepaths to the man. He says, I can't go back up there. They're going to turn me back into a dog. And the man sends back, it's the one of my favorite closing lines, he says, and they'll turn me back into a man. And that whole notion of transcendence, of the possibilities that open up when you start, you know, it's scary, it's frightening to leave behind, you know, 4 million years of human heritage or to extend it in new directions. But that closing of that Simak story has, you know, rung in my head since I read it as a kid. And that was kind of part of one of my inspirations for... you know, for going ahead with my own stories. That notion that it might be scary, it might be dangerous, it might be a disaster, but yet somehow, maybe if you were lucky enough and approached this area with enough integrity and thought, that somehow it could open up new vistas for humanity.
And that seems to be a theme that is probably really challenging for a lot of readers. It was in Blood Music, the idea that this transformed form of life would be superior in some ways. It was in Will McCarthy's, in a very similar way, in Will McCarthy's recent Bloom.
Bloom I want to read. I haven't had a chance to read Bloom yet. You'd recommend that, James?
Yeah, I would, definitely. Although the idea of a nanovirus eating humanity and then being a repository for humans in another form was from Blood Music, but it's, it's well
known. And I used it. That's how I ended the Ribofunk volume.
And also, Greg Egan seems to be pushing the idea of a post-humanity being superior. In
yes, Greg has done. He's just, you know, if I could ever, you know, come within spitting distance of his work, I'd be immensely pleased, because he's just, I think, really pushing it farther. In some cases, almost to the point of unintelligibility. It's a Barry Malzberg and I have discussed Greg's work.
He's pushing that H.G. Wells dictum.
Yeah, exactly. he might be treading very close to proving Wells right about. But no, sometimes, I mean, especially in the latest one,
who's Diaspora.
Yes, in Diaspora, there were passages in there which you felt you almost had to be one of Egan's characters in order to understand, and you wondered how he had ever written them in the first place. And Barry Malzberg and I have gone back and forth over whether Greg is just, you know, spinning his wheels and writing almost, you know, Jabberwocky prose, or if he actually has a, you know, a full conception that behind it. So.
Yeah, but do you think that this kind of fiction maybe is shifting or signaling a shift in the sophistication of at least a certain part of science
Absolutely.
Fiction consumerdom?
Yeah.
That we look
yeah.
at Star Trek and we think, you know, we're not going to be that way in 400 years.
Yes. And yeah. It just seems so silly, you know, to see these somatic body types, you know, in this far future
People
setting.
And it's 100 year lifespans
yeah.
in Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Although I just read for the convention, I reread Barry Malzberg's Galaxies, which is set in the year 3942 or something like that. And Barry, his typical Morton self, has said, well, no matter how hard they tried, they just couldn't extend the human lifespan. Everybody still died at 72, and then these people have star flight, and this is all tongue in cheek, I'm sure, on Barry's part, but just to emphasize, you know, our mortality that we probably can't really ever escape, although I'm sure people will keep pushing to escape it. Barry's going, yeah, everybody still died of cancer and heart disease and stuff, and if they nailed one thing down, something else cropped up to take its place. So you do have that kind of more phlegmatic view of how far we'll get, yeah, and changing things.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other thing that was important in Ribofunk was your use of language. You tried to really experiment with.
Well, that was kind of more, that is absolutely true. I really felt that these tales, if they were to be exemplary of a new outlook, had to, because stories are nothing but language, that the language, you know, I'm a firm believer in form following function, and I really wanted to kind of jazz these up in a, you know, quote-unquote funky sort of way, just to have a little more pyrotechnics, or a different sort of pyrotechnics than Bill Gibson or Bruce Sterling might have been using in their work. And so I worked kind of hard. A lot of slang in science fiction is totally arbitrary. You know, somebody will invent a term, you know, just a coinage that's...
Grok.
Right, like Grok. Okay, Grok has no derivation, Robert Heinlein's. And it works good enough. You know, it's a supposedly a Martian word, and so their etymology is not the... same as ours, obviously. So it works okay, and it's actually entered, you know, semi-entered mainstream vocabulary and stuff. But I felt that if I was being, you know, fairly rigorously speculative, that I should do the same with the language and derive it from actual plausible sources and
it's
stuff.
Like Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, exactly. Clockwork Orange. I think I had reread Clockwork Orange recently back in the mid-80s or so, and that was a big influence, you know, how brilliant Burgess had been in that book and stuff. So I really worked... there's a couple of... People always come up to me and ask me about... two terms in the book, and they're the two terms that I had no real firm derivation for. I just kind of, they sounded kind of nifty, and it's in the form towards the end of the book where, you know, I wanted a synonym for Mr. or Sir or whatever, so I came up with H-A-J and, you know, pronounced in my head Haj, and P-E-E-J, Peach, and I kind of use those as terms. And I had like a half-assed notion of that Hodge kind of, that no, P-E-E-J was kind of had been derived from pure genetics or something, and Hodge was hybrid genetics or something. But it didn't really, I never really supported that in the book, whereas I explained all the other terms. And those are the two terms that people invariably come up and say, well, everything else I could derive, but I couldn't figure out what those were. And it shows, it really, you know, it really pays you back to do a little groundwork when you're coining new terms and mm-hmm. trying to come up with a new language. And then I had, I'm not a big rap fan by any means. In fact, you know, my knowledge of it is minimal, but I did a story where the character had been, his brain had been rewired because there had, he had been hooked into like online, rap concert and somebody had, sent this scrambling signal, you know, over the network at the same time. And so everybody who had been listening, their minds were permanently rewired for rap. So he always talked in rhymes and stuff. So I tried, you know, I tried to toss in a few cultural
right.
Twists, you know, that I thought would support the language in the book. So
Now, your next book that's coming out is Strange Oases. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's a very tentative project. I'd love it, you know, to exist in more, solid form than it currently does. But Strange Oases is a phrase I picked up in a New York Times Daily Science article, and it was about those wonderful undersea places that have been discovered recently, the hot vents, where there's a whole nother ecology down there that, you know, is totally free from dependence on sunlight, and it lives off the heat from the hot vents and the minerals that filter up. And so the journalist, you know, I love those New York Times journalists because they can just, they seem so capable and can just zero in and pick up on a new discipline or whatever. But he coined this term. He said, you know, these undersea, we have these strange oases. And the term just stuck with me. It sounded like a great title.
Like a Laurie Anderson piece.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you've got, like, Strange has this wonderful lineage in science fiction. You've got, like, George Sabrowski's Stranger Sons, and there's a Sturgeon book that uses Strange in the title. But it's you know, and there have been pulp magazines, Strange Tales and stuff. So it just sounded like this wonderful science fictional word, you know, because strangeness is much of what science fiction is about. And so Strange Oases became the title, and then I said, well, what it would be is the basic plot of it that I have so far is that there's kind of a messiah figure born, because there's a riff in Ribofunk about how all the transgenic animals, which approach human intelligence in many cases, are kind of they're definitely an underclass. They're slaves and servants.
And they rebel at a certain point.
Yeah, and they do rebel. So I had never really examined that. I had examined, like, bits and pieces of that rebellion, but I had never gone to the heart of it, you know, whether it had succeeded or how it might have succeeded. So I pictured this messiah figure being born among the underclass of transgenic animals. And this would be the story of his career. And, of course, because he's being pursued by the authorities, you always have to think of how logically to structure the narrative so that you can visit all the places you want to visit. And if someone's being chased across the face of the globe, obviously you get to go to a lot of places.
Right.
So this would be more or less the story of his.
Is this the bunny figure?
He'd figure in it, but no, he wasn't. Yeah, Peter Rabbit. Right, I had Peter Rabbit as a transgenic creature,
rebel.
Yeah, and rebel, but no, he's not important enough. He's you know, he's like kind of the Che Guevara to this Fidel figure that that I might have in mind. So anyhow, I figured obviously character is so important. You need to focus in on your protagonist and stuff. So this messiah figure seems to me like a very interesting figure to follow, and then. The strange oases would be the various ways that man, the various locales on the globe that man has reconfigured to his to suit his new way of living and stuff. And I'll tell you one of them right now. I picture a giant Portuguese man of war that's basically city sized, and the people live instead of a floating city. It's a floating city, but it's all below the surface, and the inhabitants live inside this giant Portuguese man of war. They live among the dangling tendrils and up in the cap there and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so, but yeah, so that would be one of the strange oases. But it involves a lot of, I want to get, current on a lot of thoughts and directions in biology, and maybe a little more than I am, and do a little more serious thinking about the book before I really dive into it.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, James.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.